This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The last few shiurim have been rather difficult ones, so as we sometimes do, we'll take it a little bit easier this week. And look at starting off with something that I commented about last night. Based on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, that kol machlekes shehi l'shem shemayim soifo l'hiskayim, kol machlekes she'eino l'shem shemayim ein soifo l'hiskayim. If a machlekes, if an argument is l'shem shemayim, it's for God's sake, soifo l'hiskayim, it'll last forever. It's a strange thing to say. If it's not l'shem shemayim, it won't last. Why is it important for a machlekes to last? We mustn't get altogether negative about machlekes. Machlekes is one of these bad-sounding words, and people get quite upset about the word, but we mustn't get altogether upset about it, because as the Sfasemis and others point out, you can't have sholem if you don't have machlekes. Sholem is a very wonderful value. Sholem is Hashem's value, peace. Peace is not a static state of the absence of conflict. Peace is the resolution of conflict. Peace is solving problems, it's not avoiding problems. Peace is solving conflict, not avoiding conflict. And therefore, in an environment where there is no conflict, there also is no sholem. And that's rather important, because South Africans particularly have a tendency to avoid conflict rather than to deal with it. So the Mishnah says, no, there's nothing wrong in machlokes surviving. Because if it's a machlokes l'shem shemayim, it's not going to be a destructive machlokes, it's not going to destroy people, and it's not going to destroy communities. On the contrary, a machlokes has the capacity to create sholem. And the machlokes shehi l'shem shemayim will create sholem. What's an example of a machlokes l'shem shemayim and a machlokes it's not l'shem shemayim? So the Mishnah brings a machlokes hilul shamay, beis hilul beis shamay, as an example of a machlokes that is l'shem shemayim. And the machlekes korach v'adosu as an example of a machlekes that is not l'shem shemayim. The machlekes korach v'adosu, korach's argument with Moshe, we've discussed before what it was. And Rashi brings the background to it. What did Korach see to pick an argument with Moshe? Explains Rashi, he became jealous about the appointment of Elitzofon ben Uziel as a Nosi, as a prince. But Moshe appointed him as a prince on Bnei Kahas by God. Omar Korach reasoned, Achi Abo Arbo Hayu. There were four brothers of my father's family. Shneimar, as it says, Uvnei Kahas. The Torah lists Shemos, the sons of Kahas. One of which was Korach's, one of whom was Korach's father. Amram Habachayr, Notlu Shnei Bonov Gedula. Amram was the eldest one. Amram was the eldest one, and his two sons got a high position. Echad Melech, the Echad Kohen Godol. One is a king, and one is the high priest, the Kohen Godol. Mi roi lito les hashniya, surely the next available position should come to me. Shani ben Yitzor shu sheni l'omram, because I am the son of the second of the brothers. Amram's two children are taken care of. Then comes me. V'hu mono nasiyas ben ochi v'akoto mikulom. And he's appointed the cousin who's the son of the youngest brother. And that's not right. That's where it all started from. Last night I brought you a medrash. It was even more amazing in explaining Korach's claim. It says, my father's name was Yitzhar. And Yitzhar means oil. And whenever oil is mixed with another liquid, the oil rises to the top. So Moshe and Aaron were only anointed with oil, but I'm from the family of oil. Surely I'm the one who should get the gedulah, not them. And I explained last night that there are different ways at looking at machlokes, there are different ways of looking at conflict. The normal way, and the destructive way, is to look at the personalities involved. The conflict becomes a reason, the issue is merely a reason for the argument. But the cause, the real motivation of the argument is personalities. And most conflicts, most arguments, most machlokes are personality conflicts. The other kind of machlokes is where personalities don't come into it at all. The other kind of machlokes is where the only thing that is looked at is what are the issues. The issues right or the issues wrong. And I told you about a client of mine of a large South African company who said that the culture change that he wants to bring about in his organization is moving away from people focusing on who's right to people focusing on what is right. The focus on who's right is politics. The focus on what is right is ethics. That's the ethic, that's the correct way to deal with an issue, to deal with an argument. What is right, irrespective of who said it? It might be an argument between the chief executive and the tea girl. If you focus on who's right, then of course the chief executive's right, and the company can't grow, because it is limited then by the views of particular people, of a particular group of people. If you focus on what is right, then maybe the tea girl's right. It doesn't matter who said it. What's important is there's an issue. Let's analyze the issue and let's find out what's the right response to that particular issue. And we dealt with that last night and explained the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos along those lines. A machlokes, Hillel v'Shammai, is not a machlokes based on personalities. A machlokes, Hillel v'Shammai, is a machlokes based on the issues. Simply, what is right and what is wrong. Based on my knowledge of the halacha, what is right and what is wrong. And each person will reach a different conclusion, that's fine. But it doesn't become a personal issue, and it doesn't start off as a personal issue. The personalities involved are not relevant to the issue involved. And so the machlokes doesn't become destructive. Not only doesn't the machlokes become destructive, but it in fact is constructive, both in itself and in the relationship. It builds the relationship, it doesn't destroy it. But when it's a machlokes, Korach v'Adosoi, what does Korach say? I deserve the position. Why do I deserve the position? Because look at my yichus. My father's name was Yitzhar. We're from the oil family. Look at us. Look where we come from. I deserve it. Not the issue of what, not the question of what is the issue. What is the position? On what basis is it fulfilled? Not that at all. It becomes a personal thing. What right has Moshe and Aaron got to take the positions? And what right have they got to give to the next, to the younger, to the son of the youngest brother, when I'm not yet, and I have the yichus, and I'm the next one in line? This was a machlokes of personalities, not a machlokes of issues. And when a machlokes becomes one of personalities rather than one of issues, then it becomes destructive. And Ein Sofer Lishkayim, it doesn't last, it doesn't bring to shalom, it doesn't result in peace. A personality conflict never leads to shalom, it never leads to peace. A machlokes of issues does lead to peace. It does lead to shalom. It might be peace with the two people retaining their views. Beis Hillel never adopted the views of Beis Shammai, and Beis Shammai never adopted the views of Beis Hillel. If two great people are arguing, we don't expect them to reach uniformity. We don't expect them to reach the same opinions in order to create peace, in order to create shalom. No, if it's not a machlokes of personalities, they can maintain their differences. They can retain their separate identities. And they can respect one another for that. That's part of understanding, certainly in a Torah environment, it's part of understanding that there are inevitably going to be, and that's the richness of Torah, and that's the richness of human reason, that there will be different opinions, and we value different opinions. And it doesn't mean that one of the opinions is wrong. That doesn't have to interfere with the quality of the relationship between the people. And when it does start interfering with the quality of the relationship between the people, then it's a destructive machlokes. This is such an easy principle to use in life. It's such an easy formula to use to decide whether one's getting involved in something which is L'Shem Shemayim, what's not L'Shem Shemayim. It's very, very simple. When you see people honoring each other in their differences, you know it's L'Shem Shemayim. When you see people focusing on the issue, not on the personalities, you see it's L'Shem Shemayim. Once people start dividing each other up, and you're a supporter or you're not a supporter, or you belong to us and you don't belong to us, and that determines our relationship, that's very, very damaging and very, very dangerous. We see also Korach's whole method of lobbying support. There is such a thing as lobbying support for review. When a Sanhedrin sits down, when a Beis Din sits down and has to reach a decision, you've got certain people who take the side of the one litigant, you've got certain Dayonim who take the side of the other litigant, and they will try and persuade each other. That's the way it functions. There's nothing wrong with that. Lobbying support. The question is, on what basis are you lobbying support? Do you use the method of Talmidei Chachomim? Do you use the intellectual route, or do you use the political route? When a politician lobbies for support, he does it by promising favors. If you support me, this is what I'll give you. It's bribery. When a Talmid Chochem, or when an intellectual lobbies support, it's on the basis of the issue. Let's analyze it, let's figure out what's right, and if I can persuade you intellectually that what I'm saying is right, then you'll support it. Not because you're supporting me. That's also the difference. In a political environment, what I'm asking of you is to support me. In an intellectual environment, I'm not asking you to support me, I'm asking you to support the MS, that's all. Just figure out what's true. And if you and I happen to agree that the same thing is true, that's fine. Then we've got two votes in the same direction. But I'm not asking you to support me. I don't need your support as a person. MS needs your support. And all we've got to make sure is that you're focusing down to the truth, not to something, not to personalities. Korach was promising positions. If you support me, you'll get positions. And why should they get all the positions? The whole thing was a political exercise to gain support for office. It wasn't focused on issue. Was focused on personality. But as hard as it is sometimes to focus on what is right rather than on who is right, it's still harder to focus on the third area that crops up so often in life, and that is to decide who is right for what. So again, there's an issue of who is right, there's an issue of what is right, but there's a third issue, and that is who is right for what. That is an understanding, an ability to see correctly and clearly who's the right person for the right job, who's the best person to fulfill a particular role, and again to be focusing on the role and the importance of the role being fulfilled correctly, and not to focus exclusively on the person. And of course, this was also one of the areas that Korach desire to cause confusion. On what basis do we take these decisions to who gets what position? But implied in that whole dilemma is the issue of role clarification and role identification. There's the concept that certain people have certain roles, and that there isn't meant to be, that the Torah doesn't desire there to be a confusion of roles. Further on in the Sedra, we're given the mitzvah Vayomer Hashem el Aharon, and Hashem said to Aaron, Atol vonecho ve'sovicho itoch, you and your sons and the house of your father with you, tisu es oven hamikdash, you are responsible for the severity of the laws of the mikdash. Ve'atol vonecho itoch tisu es oven kuhunaschem, and you and your children will carry the responsibility of kuhuna. Everything that goes with kuhuna, you've got to know that you are responsible, nobody else. Ve'gam es achecho matei Levi, and your brothers, the tribe of Levi, shevet avicho hakrevitoch, that's for the tribe of your father, bring them close with you. Ve'yilavu olecho v'yishor sucho, and they will accompany you and they will back you up, they will support you. So their role is a supporting role to the kohen. The kohen has a central role in the Beis Hamikdash. Central, revolving around the clay Beis Hamikdash, the utensils of the Beis Hamikdash, and the whole sacrificial service, the Avodas Beis Hamikdash, all that is part of the Kohen's work. He has a support group, a support system from the Levim. That's why they're called Levi. The Yilovu Alecho, they will support you, they will accompany you, Vishor Sucha, and support you. The Atov Anecho Itoch, and your children with you, Lifnei Ohel Ha'idus. The Shomru Mishmatecho, Umishmeres Kol Ha'il. And they must keep, they must take care, they must guard and watch the Beis Hamikdash. That's part of the Levi's function. Achel klei hakodesh ve'el hamizbeach lo yikrovu. But they must not come close to the kelim, to the utensils of the Beis Hamikdash, or to the mizbeach, to the altar. That's not their function, that's the limit. Ve'lo yomusu gam heim gam atem. And if you observe this differentiation, this distinction of role, that they don't come near your work, and you don't come near their work, then you won't die. Implying that if you do, there is a death sentence. Different questions and different situations as to whether it's a physical death sentence or it's a death sentence b'day shemayim. But there's it's a capital offense for a levi to encroach onto the work of a kohen, or a kohen to encroach onto the work of a levi. And not only that, but even the levim with one another. Says the Sifri, "Ein li el levim she'anushim u'muzhorim al avodas kohanim, kohanim al avodas levim inayim." Does this mean only that the levim cannot do the kohen's work? Where do we know from that a kohen can't do the levi's work? Talmud Lomar gam atem. What about one levi encroaching on the work of his friend, a levi? Not just a levi doing what a kohen is doing, or a kohen doing what a levi is supposed to do. What happens if a levi is doing what another levi is supposed to be doing? Talmud Lomar gam heim. Uchvar bikesh Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya l'sayeya es Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgudo. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya wanted to help Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgudo. They were both levim. Omar lo, and he said, Chazoy l'acharecha, you get away from here. Sha'ani min ha-shoyarim, ve'ato min ha-meshoyarim. I am a doorkeeper at the Beis HaMikdash. That's my role. And don't you interfere in my work. You're one of the singers. You be a chazan. You join the choir. Leave the door alone. It's not your job. Even though they're both levim, and the levim take care of the music in the Beis HaMikdash, and the levim take care of the doorkeeping in the Beis HaMikdash, that doesn't matter. This particular levi had to keep charge of the door, and another levi had to keep charge of the had to take care of the singing. And we see that there's equal status in both. If it was a status question, then we would say the person with a lower status isn't allowed to interfere with a higher status, but we wouldn't prevent the one with a higher status from interfering with a lower status. But we're preventing it both ways and sideways. Looking after the door is not less of a status than singing. Singing is not less of a status than the kohen, although the function of the levi is supportive to the kohen. So I might think, therefore, the kohen has the greater status in the sense of the job he's allocated. Not necessarily so at all. There can be equal status even though the responsibilities are different. Because at the end of the day, the status comes from who you're working for. When you look at office politics in large organizations, what determines the status is how near the top, who are you working for? If you're working for a supervisor, then you're low down. If you're working for a director, you're higher up. If you report to the chief executive, you're still higher up. It depends who you're reporting to determines your status. And that's a good definition of status in a hierarchy. Who you report to determines your status. And that's why in Torah society and in Torah literature, the highest status of all is if you don't report to anybody. A poor self-employed person has a higher status than a wealthy employee in Torah society. To be one's own balabos is a very high status. Very high. Not reporting to anybody. So it's a good way to determine status. Who do you report to? To the boss or to somebody low down? How did it work in the Beis HaMikdash? Who do you report to? Report to the Ribbono Shel Olam. It makes no difference whether you're the doorkeeper or you're doing the korbanos, the sacrifices, or you're the kohen gadol who goes into the kodesh kedoshim. They're all working for one balabos. Their balabos, their boss is the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's it. Nobody else. And therefore their status is equal. And each individual can acquire that understanding. If we're able to bring ourselves to an understanding that I'm working for one boss, that I'm working for the Ribbono Shel Olam, then my status is in order. Then it makes no difference who I'm working for. If a person sees himself working for his superior, then yes, it depends who his superior is. That will determine his status. If a person sees that he's working for the Ribbono Shel Olam, that he has a job of work to do, that he has a sense of purpose, that Hashem has some kind of a mission for him in the world, and his work is part of that mission, and he sees it as part of a general whole, but governing the general whole, who's my boss, who am I reporting to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then my status is as high as it can possibly be. There cannot be a higher status humanly possible than serving the Ribbono Shel Olam, working for him. That's the highest status that there can be. And so we see that there is a desire in the Torah to clarify roles. There's work for a Kohen, there's work for a Kohen Gadol, there's work for a Levi. The Levim are divided into different families. The Geshuni, there's the Kahasi, the Merori, they have their different families. The Kohenim are divided into different Mishmoros, into different work teams. Each team had its own time to work, its own job to do. And there wasn't allowed to be any kind of encroachment. And very severely, the Torah treats this as a capital offense for Kohen or Levi to encroach onto the work of their fellow Kohenim or Levi. What's the reason for this? Among others, the Rambam explains in Moreh Nevuchim, in the third chelik, Perek Memhei, that v'chein huzhar kol echod me'ovdei hamikdosh milhisasek ba'avoida zulosu. And so every person who works on the Beis Hamikdosh is instructed not to deal in work that is somebody else's, that isn't his own. Ki ho'avoidos hamasurus letzibur, because work that is given over to committees, im lo yisyached kol odom ba'avoida mugderis, if each person even isn't given specific tasks, defined tasks, nothing will get done. That is, everything suffers. How often do we see this? That you get a committee of capable people, each person runs a successful business on his own, sometimes a large business, they get together as a committee and they can't make decisions, they can't do anything, they become completely immobilized. Says the Rambam, unless responsibility is defined, it isn't possible to achieve high standards of performance. And what does that mean? It's more than just defining a task. What's important is not only to know that this is my job. That's one thing. It's my job. It's an important thing to know. But there's something much more important to know. And that is that if I don't do it, nobody else will. That's what's important to know. As long as we think that if I don't do it, somebody else will do it, there's no way we're going to get any kind of quality performance. There's no way we're going to get people to excel in the jobs and the tasks they're undertaking. Even if they're working for the Ribono Shel Olam. This is not just a business principle. This works on the Beis Hamikdash. You would think the Kohanim and the Levim, with all their great minds and thoughts and their dedication to the Ribono Shel Olam, surely it wouldn't be necessary to resort to simple management techniques. No, says the Rambam. The Torah uses management techniques from the Beis Hamikdash as well. The Torah is concerned that every job gets taken care of. And if there are two people responsible for the same job, nobody will do the job properly. Each person knows that if the worst comes to the worst, there's somebody else to pick up the pieces. There has to be an understanding that the buck stops here, not only as far as the top man is concerned. At each level within an organization, at each level within a community, at each level within a Beis Hamikdash, at each level within a family, there needs to be an understanding that if I don't do this, it doesn't get done. That's one of the things that we don't do that well in the South African environment and bringing up our children. When a child knows, if he doesn't put his clothes away, the maid will or the mother will. If he doesn't wash up the dishes, there's somebody else to do it. There's always somebody else. The only person where the buck really stops is the maid. That's not the way to educate a family. There needs to be an understanding, even if it starts with small things. There need to be areas that a child learns, and that adults too. But this is my area, and if I don't do it, nobody will do it. It won't get done. One of the things you often hear South Africans comment on, particularly South African women, when they emigrate or they go for a while overseas, is that if you go out to work, as one usually has to do if one emigrates, when you come home in the evening all tired, the breakfast plates are just where you left them. Absolutely right where you left them. They haven't moved 1 millimeter. That's something we're not used to. We're used to coming back and the breakfast plates are cleaned up and back in the cupboard. It doesn't work like that. And we're used to it in a lot of different areas. That's not the way to achieve any kind of excellence. There has to be job definition. There has to be role clarification. There has to be a sense of responsibility. And responsibility isn't, as we customarily think, merely saying, you're responsible for this, you're responsible for this, this is your job, this is your job. And then you go around making sure that they do it right. And if they don't do it right, you do it yourself. That's not management. That's not creating an environment in which people take responsibility for their functions to the point where there's absolute commitment to doing it properly. And that the Ribono Shel Olam didn't want happening in the Beis Hamikdash. There's going to be absolute clarity that there's no way that somebody can step in to help me, because if they do, they'll get their head chopped off. There's no tolerance of that. You might say, surely we want to encourage people to help each other out. Surely we want to encourage people, and one would think normally that that would create a better team atmosphere. Yeah, if he didn't do the job, you finish it up. No. You finish up somebody else's work, you get killed. That's a death sentence for that. We don't tolerate that. He's got to know that it's his job, and that if he doesn't do it, nobody does that. In lo yisyached kol odom ba'avoido mugderes. If each person isn't given a specified role, yavoyu ledei rishloinus v'rifyun bakol, then one will come to weakness and incompetence in everything. Nothing will get done properly. And that role clarification we see in many areas of Jewish life. We see it in the question of Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim. Each one has their role. We see it in the definition of the Shvatim, of the tribes. That when Yaakov established Bnei Yisrael, when Yaakov established the foundation of the community of Klal Yisrael, Look how he set it up, 12 tribes, each one with a certain specific mission. The mission based on the strengths and weaknesses of that particular individual, based on the strengths and weaknesses of that particular community. We discussed in the late issue last week that it's interesting that the perfect kind of federalism we find in the Bible, in the Tanakh. The way Klal Yisrael worked, that was the way it was meant to work. Each Shevet had certain local government powers. Each Shevet had a Nossi. Each had a prince, had a president. Each Shevet, each tribe had its own flag, its own national identity, and yet it functioned as one nation. That balance between provinces and a federal unit achieved perfection already in the time of the Torah. One king, but Nesiim for every Shevet. The big difference was that the attempt to create that wasn't based on boundaries. What decides what province you're in the United States or in the New South Africa is just where you happen to be living. If you're living in this area, you belong to this state. If you live in that area, you belong to that state. Not so with the Shvatim. In the case of the Shevet, there it was you belong to that Shevet because you were born into that Shevet. And that's one of the important things of Jewish role clarification, as opposed to non-Jewish role clarification or secular role clarification. The Torah role clarification has its roots in where you're born. It's not the kind of thing you can shift artificially. Your role, your function, has a lot to do with who you really are. Not who you would like to be, not who you're pretending to be, but who you really are. And who you really are is a function of who you're born to, what family you're born into, what background you have, what skills you have, what strengths, what weaknesses you have. Those are all functions of who you really are. But one of the functions is where you're born into. And the only kind of equivalent to that you find in the secular world is the old royalty was like that. You can't become a king, can't become a prince. You're either born one or you're never one. That's it. That's the only area where that was understood. In the old days, it was understood more widely than that. A slave was born into slavery, a nobleman was born into nobility, royalty was born into royalty. The only leftovers of that is royalty to some degree. You know the lovely story of the fellow, the American guy who wants to, goes up to his rabbi and he says he wants to become a Kohen. I said, sorry, we can't do that kind of thing. He says, don't worry, I'm prepared to pay. The rabbi says, I'm sorry, we can't do that kind of thing. He says, I know the shul needs a new hall. I'll build a hall and give $1 million on top of it. He said, sorry, can't do it. So he goes to the conservative. He says, I'm willing to shift from Orthodox to conservative and give you millions of dollars, but I need to become a Kohen. Sorry, he says, not even conservatives, we don't appoint Kohenim. We don't do that kind of thing. Not a Kohen, you're a... there's no way we can make you one. After trying a little harder and not being able to shift even the conservatives, he walks up to the reform and he says, I'm willing to shift from Orthodox to reform. Think what a catch that is. And I'm willing to give you $5 million. But you've got to make me a Kohen. He says, the reform rabbi, with pleasure. Give me your $5 million and I'll give you a certificate that you're a Kohen. And we'll make a dinner for you. Oh, says the Kohen, this is what I like. This is the way a person should be treated. He gives his $5 million, he gets his certificate that he's a Kohen, he's called up at the Torah as a Kohen. And he has a banquet, and he's sitting at the top table next to the Reform Rabbi, and the Reform Rabbi says to him, as a matter of interest, why is it so important to you that you're willing to pay $5 million to become a Kohen? He says, Rabbi, my grandfather was a Kohen, my father was a Kohen, do you think I'm not going to be a Kohen? That's how it is, that the roles that we have to be based not only on what we would like to be and on what we pretend that we are. The the roles that we undertake have to be things that we're really steeped in, things that we really are. And that's a function of many things, and one of them is what we're born into. And that's how our Shvatim worked, that's how our tribes have worked, that we've been born into it. And that's what's so unique. In Europe, if you take the European model as opposed to the United States model, they're trying to do it there. Because there's a difference. A Frenchman is not a German, and a German is not an Italian, and an Italian is not a Spaniard. And they're trying to make one Europe. They're not succeeding. So in the States, you've got a situation which is artificial tribes, artificial provinces. I'm sure that works to some sort of sense, but it's meaningless. In Europe, where they've got real differences, where you're born a Frenchman and you're proud to be a Frenchman, and you're born a German and you're proud to be a German, or you're born an Italian and so on, there it isn't working the same way. They're not able to actually bring it together. They're not actually able to create one united Europe out of it. The only case where it's actually worked, where it's really worked, has been among B'nai Yisroel, where people remained faithful and loyal and associated intimately with their own tribe, the tribe into which they were born. They could not select, they could not convert. and yet they were part of a national identity which functioned as one nation. But there was that role, there was the Yisachar and Zvulun situation, where the one was dedicated to Torah learning and the other supported him in Torah learning. They didn't try and swap roles. It wasn't a question of which one was more important, although one was supportive, or one appeared to be supportive. The Torah learners were being supported by the business people. But they weren't seen as in any kind of lower status. They were equal partners. That was their role. And each shevet had its particular quality, born into it or engendered into it, already by Yaakov. When Yaakov gave his brachas at the end of Bereishis to each of his sons, he identified what the strengths and weaknesses of each of them were, and where they need to develop, and how they need to develop, and how they need to build that, not to try and change that. So we have it politically, we have it with a king, we have it with religiously with the Kohen, the Levi, and the Yisrael. We have it socially. We have the concept of a Talmid Chacham, we have the concept of a Balabos, a lay leader. A lay leader doesn't mean a secular leader. A lay leader is also a Ben Torah. A lay leader is also somebody who's learnt or who's close to learning. But that, he doesn't see that as his role. He doesn't see his role as making his contribution through learning. There are other ways that he makes his contribution. And it's one of them. My father used to comment that it's one of the sad facts of contemporary Torah life, is that we're discouraging this diversity of role. That we've kind of set a standard. Everybody's supposed to be a Ben Torah. Everybody's got to go to Yeshiva. Everybody's got to go to Kollel. Everybody's got to follow exactly the same pattern and career path. And that's the only one that's okay. And if you're not one of those, if you haven't followed that career path, you really haven't made it. And the only thing that every frum girl should do is to marry somebody who's learning in Torah, and irrespective of whether he's learning well or isn't learning well, irrespective of whether he's a particularly nice person or isn't, what's important is that he's doing nothing but learning, and she should work to support him. That's it. That's the role model for every single frum girl, no matter what, no matter who, where she comes from. That's what everybody has to do. Everybody goes to Yeshiva. Everybody goes to Kollel. Everybody lives in Hanof. That's what has to be. Otherwise, you're just not part of it. You're not part of the scene. We have standardized it to the point that we've deprived Klal Yisrael of the diversity of roles that makes us a nation. And so frum society, in fact, is losing that ability to be a community. And people often complain in Eretz Yisrael, there aren't communities. What does it mean there aren't communities? How can there not be communities? There are tens of thousands of Bnei Torah. There are tens of thousands. There are thousands of Rabbonim, of Talmidei Chachomim, of great Talmidei Chachomim. Fine people, fine Talmidei Chachomim. How can't there be communities? Because you can't just make a community out of Rabbonim. You can't just make a community out of people who are learning. A community needs to be a collection of diverse people with diverse strengths and weaknesses who are able to complement each other and together create a community. That's what a community is. And there's a role for lay leadership, and there's a role for business people, and there's a role for professional people, and there's a role for teachers, and there's a role for writers, and there's a role for rabbonim, and there's a role for dayonim, and for Rosh Yeshiva. These are all different people with different strengths who pool those strengths to create a community. That's how it needs to be. There's the book that I referred to a little while ago, A Fire in His Soul, that is really prescribed reading, about Irving Bunim, who died 10 years ago or so, who was a Balabos. He was born in Balozhin, but he was raised in New York, and he was a Balabos. He was a successful businessman, but he made everything that Rabbi Aaron Kotler achieved in America, he made it possible. But Aaron Kotler, any single person can be given the credit of bringing unadulterated pure Torah to America, but Aaron Kotler is the man. There were others, and Talmud Yeshiva was established in New York. There was Torah. There was Torah in many parts of America. But that unadulterated pure Torah, which until then had existed only in Eastern Europe, there were a few people who took it to Eretz Yisrael, the Briskerov, the Chazon Ish, Ponovizhorov. There were a few people who took it to Eretz Yisrael and re-established it in Israel. And the person who really took unadulterated Torah and built it into American society without compromise, and not allowing compromise at times where that was extremely difficult, that was Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Rabbi Aaron Kotler established what is today probably the biggest and one of the greatest yeshivas in the world, and he established a whole society of Bnei Torah in the United States. But it's clear that Rabbi Aaron Kotler wouldn't have been able to do that without Irving Bunim. Irving Bunim was a balabos. Was in the clothing trade, in the textile trade, active balabos. And what he could do things that Rabbi Aaron Kotler couldn't do. He established the Vada Hatzolah. The Vada Hatzolah was created to save Jews from Europe, and he saved tens of thousands of people. he did it. The Rabbonim couldn't do it. It needed constant work. It needed calling on the business people of the United States, pressurizing them to lobby the government. He had to call on the senators and congressmen. He had to call on the president of the United States. He needed a lot of pressure and a lot of forcefulness. He needed to be able to pull strings that Rabbonim can't pull. A balabos who's dedicated to Torah can achieve incredible things that are far beyond what a rov can achieve, or what a group of Rabbonim can achieve, or what a Beis Din can achieve. There's an incredibly important upfront role for lay leadership, for Torah lay leadership. An upfront role. A supportive role, yes, like the Levim were supportive. Does that make them any less? It doesn't make them any less. That is their function. That is their role. Irvin Bunning didn't decide. He was a Ben Torah. He used to learn. His son became a Rav. But he didn't decide that it's better. I want to try and be a fake Rav Aaron Kotler. Let me dress up like Rav Aaron Kotler. And I'll act like Rav Aaron Kotler. That will be my role, like people do today. Everybody dresses up like Rav Aaron Kotler and tries to act like Rav Aaron Kotler. Irvin Bunim didn't. He never grew a beard. He used to wear a short jacket. Just looked like an ordinary businessman. The only way you could tell he was from, he used to wear a yarmulke. That was all. Didn't have tzitzis up. Nothing. Ordinary person. But he was one of Rav Aaron Kotler's closest friends and was his closest associate. And together they built Torah and Eretz Yisrael as a partnership. That function hardly exists anymore in America. As a partnership, that function hardly exists anymore, because it's infradig to be a balabos. If you haven't gone to yeshiva and kollel and you're not full time in learning, you haven't quite made it. It isn't so. It's very important to learn Torah, and it's very important for those who have the capacity and those who are going to develop in that way to be in full time learning, but it's not for everybody. And those who don't do it aren't. It isn't a question of you haven't made it. It's a question of identifying what does the Ribbono Shel Olam want from me. Taking into account where I'm born, to who I'm born, what my education is, where I'm holding in my life, where could I make the greatest contribution to Torah? That's what's important. Is my greatest contribution to Torah going to be as a secular, by that I don't mean non-Torah, I mean non-full-time Torah, lay leader, active person, or not? When it comes to tzedakah and chesed, a lay leader can do things that a rov can't do. A lay leader who himself is about tzedakah, a layperson, a businessman who himself gives charity. Do you know what charity he can raise? It's very difficult for a Rav. How much tzedakah can the Rabbonim give? They hardly earn anything. What are they going to give still tzedakah? A little bit they can give. So they phone up a balabos and ask him to give some tzedakah. They've got no bargaining power. But when a businessman phones up 10 of his friends and says, look here, I've given 10,000 rand to this organization, how about you doing the same? Very difficult to refuse him. Very difficult. And that's what Irvin Bunim used to do. And they tell the lovely story of how his wife once decided to make a shidduch party. She would she'd get some young men and some young women over and enable some socialization, which she did. She invited all the bachelors that she knew, and she invited all the spinsters that she knew to have a dinner at their home, and that way they would be introduced to each other, a kind of a singles thing. This was years ago. There's a ring at the door, one young lady comes, a second young lady, a third young lady. It's already 45 minutes, all the young ladies are there, not one guy is there. So poor Irvin Bunim starts getting really upset and worried about this, picks up the phone, and he phones the first one, and the guy says to him, Irvin, my friend, you don't have to do that to me. Just tell me how much and I'll send you a check. There was an assumption that if you were invited to something by Irvin Bunim, it was going to cost you. And that they knew that. That was the way he raised millions and millions for tzedakah. That's what he did. That's how he functioned. Today, a balabos doesn't do that, a frum balabos, because he thinks he's second rate. Still going to ask people for money. I'm a failure. I didn't make it in Torah. I'm just an ordinary balabos. No such thing as just an ordinary balabos. That's where we need leadership. That's where we need thinking. That's where we need talent. That's where we need activeness. That's where we need proactive involvement in Torah. Not a secondary involvement in Torah. Because in fact, quite amazing. Last Shabbos, you know that we've been talking about bringing out a rather dynamic team from Eretz Yisrael, from Esha Torah, scientists and Rabbonim for the next Shabbaton and the days before and afterwards, to deal with the conflicts between science and religion and secular life with religious life and so on. They're a team specialized in that area. We were looking at bringing them out, but the question was that it costs a lot of money to bring a team of people out, and we don't have that money. And it was last, you see how leadership in a balabos works. Last Shabbos, and I'm busy hesitating, and can't we, and we don't have the money, it's irresponsible. And Mr. Raff, one of the kind of the balabatim that I'm talking about, comes to me on Shabbos and says, you know, we've always had a policy in this Beis HaMedrash. We've always decided what's right first and looked for the money afterwards. Why are we hesitating now? If it's the right thing to do, let's do it. and we worry about the money afterwards. And he couldn't convince me. I was still feeling a bit uneasy about it. And then he came up to me and he said, before the Motzei Shabbos share, he says, look, I've decided we're going ahead with it. We don't have the money, we're doing it. That's what I call a balabos. Comes to the Rav and says, I've decided we're doing it. Finished. In principle, we've agreed. Now the only question is the practicality. And what Ronnie was saying to me was, the practicality is not your business. The principle you've agreed with, we're going ahead. He said, I just ask you one favor. Won't you say in the Motzei Shabbos share, tell people that we're doing this, and maybe there'll be people in the Motzei Shabbos share that will help. So I said to Ronnie, no, I won't do that. I'll tell people that we're doing it, but I won't say that we need help. No, fine. So Ronnie won half the battle. So you remember I did. I said that. After the Motzei Shabbos share, here you see what a balabos can do. Here we are hamstrung. We can't move. We want to do something exciting and we can't move. A balabos and his wife come to see me after the share right here, 1 week ago. They've asked not to be named, so I won't name them. And they said, we heard you're planning to bring people out. That must cost you money. We'll make available immediately, so that you don't have to worry, 25,000 rand. That's not a couple who can easily afford it at all. Not at all. It's a feeling of what a balabos can do. What can be facilitated. So what will be the result of that? A team will come out, Mirtz Hashem, and we'll have a wonderful Shabbaton, and hundreds of people will be exposed to them. And of those hundreds of people, some will go to yeshiva, some will live a more religious life, some will have greater values. Who knows how it will impact on all sorts of different people? Thanks to who? To a balabos who's sitting on a chair and says, what can I do to make this happen? What can I do to assist? What can I do to help? That's the role of a balabos. There's no way the Torah can flourish. There's no way the Torah can develop if balabatim see themselves as the audience. If balabatim see themselves as the passengers, if balabatim see themselves as the clients, as the customers, they're not. There are no clients, there are no customers. We're all active, we've all got a job to do. There's only one client, only one customer. That's Ribbono Shel Olam. He's the only one that we're here to serve. Not anybody else, the rest of us work for him. We're all in the same company, we're all in the same job. But we have different roles. And we have to look at our roles and examine, with the assets, with the skills, with the abilities that I've got, what can I do to make things happen? Not, yes, I'll come, we already have it, it's a gross favor, we have people who say, they'll come to the Shabbaton, please let me know when it's happening. It's already a big thing, at least they've said that. But that's not enough. I'm not just talking about a Shabbaton, I'm not just talking about this place, I'm talking about the community, I'm not just talking about our community here, I'm talking about the worldwide Torah community. There needs to be a constant questioning of oneself. What can I do to make it happen? What can I do to bring things a step further in any area in which I'm active? Same applies in the business situation. Isn't that what we want of our employees? Don't we want our employees to come forward and say, I think I can take on such and such, I can do such and such? There is a role for everybody, and that role needs to be clarified. But it needs to be clarified by the person themselves. Based on who you are, and what you are, and what you know, and where you come from, it's not that difficult to figure out, what can I do to help? Sometimes it will be physical help, sometimes it's emotional encouragement, sometimes it's material help, sometimes it's spiritual help. It doesn't matter. For people to come and to come forward, at least in some way, in some area. Sometimes we've been sitting in shiurim for years, and you go and ask them for a bit of help, they can't see how they're able to do so. To have Kanan Hora people who come forward without being asked, that's very, very wonderful, that's very special. Role clarification applies also in the area of men and women, husband and wife. They have different roles, they have different jobs to do. And I don't want to go in detail in this year as to what their jobs are, except to set aside certain misconceptions from a piece of Shulchan Aruch which I've used fairly often in the past, but it can't be overstressed enough. Take the husband-wife role, the family role. If you were to ask the average Jewish person, male or female, what is the Jewish, how does the Torah see the role of the woman? What is her job? What is her function? We would get the kind of answers to take care of the home, to do the cooking, feed the family, take care of the children. It's part of it, that's what her role is. But that isn't what her role is. The Shulchan Aruch says in Evan Ezer, Siman Pei, Yesh melachos shehoisha oisa lebailo Bizman Shehem Anim. There are certain jobs that a wife has to do for her husband when they're poor. Ve'elohem, these are they. Netachenes, she grinds. In those days you didn't just buy ground flour, you had to grind it yourself. Ve'ofo, she bakes, if they're poor. Umechabese, she does the laundry, if they're poor. Umevasheles, and she cooks, if they're poor. Umenikes beno, and she feeds his son, his children, breastfeeds them, if they're poor. One would think breastfeeding is one of the obvious things that is a mother's role. Yes, says the Shulchan Aruch, if they're poor. V'nusenes teven lifnei behemto, and even she has to feed the cattle, she has to, before the cattle, she has to put straw there. Ichnisa lo shivcho achas, and the chosim shoyim ichnus mehem shivcho achas, but once they can afford one servant, so he has enough money to pay for one servant. The first thing she stops is the kitchen work. She's out of the kitchen. No more grinding, no more baking, no more laundry. She still cooks. If they can afford two servants, the next thing that comes off the list, if she can afford two servants, then she stops cooking. And she stops breastfeeding. It's not her job. Yes, it's true. If they can't afford it, who's going to breastfeed? He can't breastfeed. So she has to breastfeed. Fine. That's the only reason. Not because it's her job. It's because it's her job in the event that there isn't anybody else there. But she has a brain of her own. It doesn't mean that she has to be tied to the kitchen and that she has to be tied to raising the children. It's only in the event of poverty. If there isn't anybody else to do it, then she has to do it. But if they can hire somebody to do it, she doesn't have to do that. Says the Shulchan Aruch in the same siman, Hamadir is ishto ishele ta'aseh melocha. If a husband takes a vow forbidding his wife to work, you would think that's wonderful, heaven, sure, fantastic. I'll take care of you, I don't want you to work, and I swear, I will not allow you to work. Yotzi v'yitin ksuva, he must divorce her immediately. They are not allowed to live together under such circumstances. Sha'abateilo mevi'yali de'imzimun, because the boredom of a woman who's not working brings to all sorts of negative activities. It's just not healthy to be that way. It's desired that the woman takes on work, not necessarily outside the home, it can be work in the home, but not home work. Work for real work, where she earns something from it, where she creates something. She does the things that the Gemara lists and that the Shulchan Aruch brings are things like knitting and sewing and weaving and these kind of things, creative things. But if it's not that today, there are all sorts of other jobs that women can do even from the home. But she not only has a right to work, she has an obligation to work. Not an obligation to him, an obligation to herself. An obligation to the family. So that there's something going into her mind as well, that there's some kind of creative process taking place, that she doesn't just sit around. There's certain things, though, that she can't delegate. And again, I'm reading from the Shulchan Aruch. I wouldn't have the guts to say it myself, but this is what it says. And therefore, every Jewish wife should wash her husband's brow and his hands and feet when he comes home. Every Jewish wife. And she prepares a cup of tea for him, or a glass of whiskey if he prefers it. And she makes the bed. The omedes umeshameshes bifnei bailo. And she stands and serves him. Kigun shetitein lo mayim or kli. She brings him water, or if he wants whatever he needs. Or shetitel milafonov, she takes it away. Uchiyetze bidvorim ayel, and other such things. Now look, South Africa is an interesting society because we've been able to afford servants, at least to some degree, which there are not many other societies. So what have we delegated to the servants? Or what do we not feel guilty about delegating? The serving at the table, that's fine. Making the beds is fine. But the cooking and the taking care of the children, that we're not going to delegate it to maids and to servants. It's back to front. The wife's role are the intimacies of the relationship. Those little jobs that are intimate, not degrading. We look at them and we think, is that degrading? Look what she's got to serve. It's not degrading. That's the intimacy. As we've discussed previously, and I don't want to go into this because this isn't a marriage issue. She rebuilds his damaged ego that way. He comes back from outside in the marketplace with a damaged ego, because that's what happens in the marketplace. You're knocked by everybody. customers, suppliers, bank managers, everybody knocks the person outside. He comes back damaged. She has to rebuild him. Not for his good, for her good. If you look in all the marriage counseling sessions, what are women complaining of? The kind of things they want from their husbands need egos that are intact to be able to give their wives. But they're not willing to build their husbands' egos. That's work you can't delegate, the building of the husband's ego. Melachos eilu oiso yison ba'atzmo ve'afilu oyulu kama shluchos. These jobs she does herself, no matter how many servants they've got. Einoisim melachos eilu lebal elo ishto. Nobody but his wife should do these things for him. That's where the relationship is constructed. There are roles, but the role isn't quite what we think the role to be. The role of the Jewish woman is not to cook and bake. The role of the Jewish woman is to construct, to help reconstruct the husband's ego. That's a role. That's how the partnership is established. And that enables him to go out again with pride and with strength and to do his work and to succeed. She's the motivator. Why do you think companies have to hire motivators? People who charge fortunes to come and tell people that they're okay, they're really good and they should go out there and do it. Why do you have to hire motivators? Because they come from broken homes, that's why. Because their wives aren't doing it. It shouldn't be necessary. A man should be able to go out every morning fully motivated. Who motivates him? His wife motivates him. I think I've told you the story before. I used to work in a company that used to be very careful about spending money, and even the chief executive used to fly economy class and stay in ordinary sorts of hotels. They used to be very, not because they couldn't afford it, that was their way, that was their policy. And one day I was a very young man, and I had to go and negotiate with some very high profile people in London, just for a day. They came and told me, you've got to go tomorrow, and this is what you're going to do, these are the people you've got to meet with. And I made my arrangements. And the chief executive phoned me up and he said, I hope you're going first class. I said, of course not. You never do. What do you think? I'm going to go first class. He said, you're a nobody. You're a nothing. And you're going to go and talk to big shots. You'd better make sure that you've been pampered the night before. You go first class. Let them treat you like a king. And you walk off that plane feeling like a king. Then you'll succeed in your negotiations. That's what every husband should have at home. He should be traveling first class, so that he can walk out of his home and he's been treated like a king. That's the role of the Jewish woman. That's the role of the Jewish woman. Is it a derogatory role? Well, if being a Levi is a derogatory role, if being a Kohen is a derogatory role, then being a wife is also a derogatory role. You might have homes where they want to switch. Fine. Let the woman go out and do the work, and let the wife and let the husband be the motivator. Let the husband treat her like the queen. Fine, if that's the arrangement they want to come to. When the Torah suggests that that's the woman's role and that's the man's role, it's because that's how they're designed. The woman is better at that than the man is. The man is better at going out to work than the woman is. The man gets less damaged by the hammering that you get in the marketplace than the woman does, and the woman has more skills at building up egos, at making people feel good. It's already been established throughout the world that in the service industries, and today most industries are becoming service orientated, in service industries women excel men in performance. And that's one of the reasons that women are really taking over in the commercial world. Not just because of women's lib and because women are getting out there, because business has become service orientated. And women know how to do that. Women know how to motivate. Women know how to make a person feel good. Women know how to rebuild damaged self-esteem. And they're able to use that skill and to use that ability. But the most important place to use it is at home with their husbands. Then there's proper shalom bias. Then the home is built and the home is constructed properly. Different roles, different functions. And finally, as we said briefly this morning, sometimes the same person has to fulfill different roles. And that's also okay. We discussed this morning there's a private role and there's a public role. There's a role in the home and there's a role outside and there's outside in public. And they're different. That's understandable. The way one is when one unwinds at home is different when one's at work, when one's doing one's job and one's fulfilling one's responsibilities. And that's okay, but there has to be a certain consistency. There has to be a certain integrity between the roles that are played out at home and the role that is played outside. And it's that integrity that is maintained by the mitzvahs that Korach attacked. Korach attacked the mitzvah of tzitzis and the mitzvah of mezuzah. And as I explained this morning, the mitzvah of tzitzis and mezuzah, Korach saw as external manifestations, as exhibitionism, as ostentation. And Korach acknowledged that maybe you need that when the inside isn't what it ought to be, so you need to be reminded. And so if the house isn't full of sforim, you need a mezuzah. If the clothing is not fully tchelis, you need tzitzis. But if the clothing is fully tcheles, and if the house is packed with tforim, surely you don't need a mezuzah, surely you don't need to tell the world. If everything inside is in order, what do you need the mezuzah for? Is it just an act of public ostentation? And we explain, no, he chose the two mitzvahs that are placed at the point of interface between the private man and the public man. The mezuzah is not outside. The mezuzah is in the doorway, just at that point where public and private merge. The tzitzis are not outside. The tzitzis are on your clothing, at the tips, at the edge of your clothing, just at the point where the public and the private merge. Those are the points that tzitzis and mezuzah focus on. That point of merging. And what is a mezuzah? And mezuzah contains the first two paragraphs of the Shema. And tzitzis, that's the third paragraph of the Shema. So Korach was attacking the Shema. That's what he was attacking. And what do we see from Parshas Korach? We learn from Parshas Korach the essence of Kriya Shema, what Shema really is. Shema is putting down in a simple, clearly defined formula the integrity that has to be maintained as the roles switch. From the private to the public, back to the private, we do change roles. We do act differently, we do function differently, we even think differently. That's all okay, within certain parameters. But there has to be a common thread. And the common thread is contained in the Shema. The first two paragraphs of the Shema are on the doors of our houses every time we walk in and out, and the third paragraph of the Shema is on our tzitzis. So that all in all, it's the Shema that maintains that thread of integrity wherever we go. And let's look through briefly what there is in the Shema. What is that integrity that needs to be there? You need to love the Ribbono Shel Olam, number one. The after, firstly, it's Shema Yisrael, it's acknowledging the oneness of Hashem. That no matter what we are, public, private, work, home, social, makes no difference in what activity we are. There's one Ribbono Shel Olam. The halacha that governs us at work is the same halacha that governs us in shul, it's the same halacha that governs us at home, it's the same halacha that governs us wherever we are. There's one Ribbono Shel Olam, one Torah, one system of halacha. That you can't change with the roles. When you're moving from the one role to the other, that has to remain primary in your mind at all times. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It's one. Then there needs to be a love of Hashem, dedication to Hashem. But most important in the first paragraph of Shema is the learning process. These words must be on your heart. You must teach them to your children. You must talk about it. Whether you're walking at home, or whether you're sitting at home, or you're walking outside, whether you're lying down or you're waking up. Tefillin used to be worn all day. We don't do that anymore, but tefillin used to be worn all day. And tefillin, there are three parts to the tefillin. Tefillin governs or connects the integrity of the arm, the practical part of the human being, with the heart, the emotional part of the human being, and the mind, the intellectual part of the human being. Bind it together into one unit. Don't have a thinking system that has nothing to do with your emotional system, but in turn has nothing to do with your active system, with your mechanical system. It all has to be integrated. It has to be one human being. That can't change. That has to be the same, whether you're at home or you're outside, whether you're in shul or you're at work. That concept of the integrity of your personality, that has to be there. And that's all dedicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That dedication to Hashem, you will express your dedication in different ways. The things you do when you're in shul are different to the things you do at home. The things you do at home are different to the things you do at work. Your moods might change, your personality style might change. But your integrity and its commitment to Hashem, that doesn't change. And your commitment to learning, that makes no difference who you are and what stage of learning you are. It's not only talking about formal learning, it's talking about an ongoing process of thinking, of questioning, of analyzing, of innovating. Constantly thinking, constantly applying what you see to the Torah, and applying the Torah to what you see. Walking around with a Torah idea in your mind, and interpreting the world using those Torah ideas. That's the purpose of a shiur such as this. To provide one with some kind of framework and input for the week, to be able to go around and interpret events and interpret ideas from a perspective of thinking. To actually do that, that's for limadatim oisam. That's for shinantam levonecha. The second paragraph of the Shema is to link success to morality. That's the second paragraph. But if you see material success, it's because of a hoyoim shomoya. If you see that there isn't material success, then you know it's because of pen yiftel levavche. Simple as that. To watch out for it. Notice it. Don't let it pass you by. Notice the difference between the way you perform on the days where you've davened properly compared to the days when you haven't davened properly. Notice the difference in your performance and in your success on the days where you've learned something as well on the days when you haven't learned. Notice the linkage. It's so obvious. I'm not commenting just on my own. It's from everybody I've ever spoken to there's a linkage. If you'll just stop and look at it. That can't change whether you're at home or you're outside, whether you're private or public. That needs to be all the time. You need to be focusing and noticing that there's a direct link between the morality and the success. And then comes the third paragraph, which is tzitzis. The way we present ourselves to the world, the way the world sees us. But there has to be some kind of an integrity there as well. That's what the Shema stands for. That's what the mezuzah stands for. That's what the tzitzis stands for. Yes, not only are there different roles for different people, but sometimes there are different roles for the same person. And he has to move, he has to shift from one role to another. But the point that Korach didn't understand, the point that the Shema teaches us, the point that is so essential to the quality of Jewish life, is understanding not only that my role nobody else can play. There isn't anybody else to be me. Irving Bunim knew there wasn't another Irving Bunim. He knew that if he didn't do it, nobody could do it, not even Rabbi Aaron Kotler. That's what one has to understand. If I don't do it, nobody will do it. There isn't somebody else who can play the role that I can play. I have to identify that role. And there might, it might be multifaceted. I might have several different roles to play. But no matter who we are, whether it's one person playing several roles or several people playing their own roles, there is an integrity that binds us all, the integrity expressed in the Shema, the integrity of one of dedicating ourselves to the oneness of Hashem, to the constant activity of learning, and to the linkage of our successes and failures to our level in Torah and Yerushalayim. With that, we're able to conquer the issues that Korach raised. We're able to ensure that any machlokesim that we have, that when we involve ourselves in dispute, it's l'shem shamayim and not shalom l'shem shamayim. That we're able to focus not on who is right, but on what is right. And in determining our roles, we're able to focus not only on what is right, but also on who is right for what. To dedicate ourselves in that and to succeed in what we attempt.